Albany, where it would be evaluated. If it didn't pass, you'd get a letter. If it didn't pass three times in a row, you'd lose your permit for that product. So you treated that stuff pretty seriously, especially when you got two out of four and you go, oh my God, three out of four, you're up. And then they would have a rating side of it. There were three rating officers in New York who would come to the plants and do a rating. And you needed the rating to go across state lines. If you failed the rating, your milk was not going across state lines, nor was it going into a government-funded program like West Point. We did produce the milk for West Point. You'd lose West Point. Couldn't be able to sell in Pennsylvania. So it was pretty serious stuff when that started happening. And their oversight of the rating officers would be an FDA regional milk specialist who would come randomly. Yeah, I don't think there was a time on it, but he usually came every 2 years too. And he would do the oversight to make sure the regulatory people, the local ones, were doing their job. And that's called a check rating. And he wanted to do good on that one too. It's the same consequences. It could pull the plug on you. There was a little more leeway there. Regular ratings, you had to have at least a 90% compliance. On your check ratings, you could drop 10 points from that 80% and still survive. If it was bad enough, nobody's going to survive that. You know, or if something serious, and you still were above 80, you're not going to make it if there was a pasteurizer problem or something. Pasteurizing is pretty serious stuff. And, back in the days of the turn of the century and all that, the dairy industry was really killing people through not pasteurizing, milk-borne diseases, undulate fever, tuberculosis. They used to test cows for tuberculosis. And pasteurization would take care of most of that stuff, the pathogenic organisms. The good bacteria made it through. You always had some there. You just didn't want the psychrophiles, the ones that grow at refrigerated temperatures. And from when I started, we were putting 12 days code on the milk, and now they're putting 28 on conventional milk, and we're up to 90 on extended shelf life. Literally the package will go bad before the product does.
On the flip side of that, how's the relationship between the farmers and processing?
Yeah, nowadays, there is one cooperative who has processing plants. There are a few around the country. But right here, what I was familiar with, the interface you would have with the farmers wasn't that much. You would order your milk, call Dairy Leah, which is in Syracuse. They're just, all they got is farmers and milk, and say, I need so many this day, so many that day, and line your milk up, and they would have it delivered. Of course, if you found a bad tanker, they're checked pretty thoroughly when they come in. For antibiotics, a cow gets sick and they give them antibiotics to fix it, and they're supposed to withhold the milk. And they don't, and you find a positive antibiotic, and what could go wrong? Somebody could have a reaction to it if they were had an allergy to it. Or the other thing is, if you've given people a low dose of it all along, now they build up a resistance. Bacteria in their system builds up a resistance to that particular antibiotic, and that's not good. And so you'd call the co-op and tell them they had a bad load, and you got to take care of it. And usually it goes back to the farm. Every time a tanker backs into a farm, they take a sample out of the farmer's tank. And take it with them before they load it, so we know which farm it came from if there's a bad load, and then it's the co-op's problem. And usually it goes back to the farm, it screwed it up, and they dump it in his fields. And he'll get a fine. And that would be the day-to-day involvement with the co-op. Now, you really don't see the farmers. There'd be relationships higher up where senior executives would interface with the cooperatives. And the cooperatives is kind of it's different than it was. They're still Dairy League, but they're part of something else, Dairy Farmers of America, something. And that's consolidating, too. So, and at the pasteurized milk ordinance conferences, yeah, you'd butt heads with the producers, processors would, because we'd want certain things our way, and they would want the things more friendly to for the farmer side of it, and you know do all this politics back and forth and try to come up with something everybody can live with. It was kind of a consensus group, you know, wanted to walk away. Everybody could live with what it was. No real explosive stuff. So I wouldn't have much interface with the regulatory people or with the production people. I would see them at conferences and we're all good and we're all buddies and everything, but not a lot of day-to-day stuff.
I believe it was the Queens plant that had the union in it. Was the union common in dairy industry?
It was by companies. In Dairy Lee, all the plants were unionized in the Teamsters. And there'd be a shop steward there, and a whole mess there where you come up with grievances from guys and you'd have to sit down and have a hearing. And then it had a strike. The Queens plant had a strike once and shut everything down. It wouldn't let milk into the city. We were the close in Goshen. We were the closest milk plant to the city. So we were like working 24/7 to produce milk, and we'd have all these stores and milk dealers coming up to our back dock and buying off the back dock and taking it back down. We had a few of the local in New York, I forget, five something, a few of them come up and pick it. And of course the brother union guy isn't supposed to cross a picket line, so that didn't come up that much. But we did have trouble down there. When we would send a load of milk into the city, we were using plane trailers and plane tractors, so they wouldn't, you wouldn't know it was a milk truck. You wouldn't see a Dairy Lee truck sneaking into the city. We had a tanker, I think, had a bullet hole in it. Didn't know where that came from. And they stopped the tractor trailer and made him disconnect from his tractor from the trailer, and all that weight just boom down on the ground, and milk running out of it all over the place. So there was some serious stuff going on there. And finally the arbitrator went in, and this is a tactic. Okay, guys, we're here. Nobody's leaving until we come out with a settlement. You're not leaving. You're not going to the bathroom. You're not doing anything. We're going to stay here till we get this worked out. And they got it worked out, and everybody was happy after that. Hood, on the other hand, didn't have any union plants. Everything was non-union, and still is today. They'd like to think it's they treat the employee better. I guess they kind of do. They inherited the Dairy Lee union plants, and then later on they bought Crowley's, and Crowley's had union plants, so they inherited those. They deal with it the best way they can. Every time every once in a while you get an organizer, you know, union rep that targets a plant and comes in and wants to talk to the people, and he's outside giving them flyers, and they're trying to have meetings and all that. And it's, and the lawyer, we have a lawyer go to the plant to make sure they're not breaking any laws. He stays there till they finally give up, and the union votes, or the employees vote, and they don't want to join the union. They want to stay the way they are. They like things the way they are.
So you're talking about the new type of bottle and that process, but have you noticed other ways that the dairy industry has changed since you got into it?
Yeah, it's a consolidation. Quality is expected. There's the code is set by you. It used to be set by the regulatory people. And New York City, that Queens plant, was just 72 hours, 3 days. Well, that they didn't realize it, but they were just hurting themselves because there was no incentive for the plant to clean up and do all the good things to get a 14-day code. Why bother? You know, you got to bring it back in 72 hours. And so that's one thing. The codes have all gotten a lot longer. Dairy industry learns from problems. There was a problem in a Jewel Tea plant in Chicago in the 80s, and they were somehow salmonella was getting into the plant, and people were getting sick all over the place. And that started a real drive with the whole dairy industry, the Milk Safety Initiative of the 80s. And we were all going to conferences and coming back to the plants, and they weren't sure what happened there. They still aren't sure. Guys have their own theories. You know, some disgruntled employee did something, or maybe a cross-connection. You had a raw milk line that somehow cross-connected into a pasteurized milk line. So there was a real drive there to go back to your plants and make sure you had a set of drawings for the plant that were accurate. And then you had to go out and physically label the pipelines as to what they were. And there was a universal color code. Blue was the pasteurized, red was raw, and I think orange was water. They were the main things you'd have in a plant. Water line going into a CIP system, clean in place. And then they kept carrying it farther. Okay, now we've got everything color-coded. Maybe we got a color-code to brushes. So then, because, a GMP thing is they're called a bottle brush, a universal brush in a milk plant. And you'd find one in the restroom that they would be cleaning toilets with. And you can't do that because who knows? Somebody gets short some night and they go in there, here's a brush, I can't find mine, but here's another one, and it gets back out there. So they were color-coding brushes. It was blue for pasteurized equipment, red for if it was going to be used on raw equipment, black if it was used on the floor. So, that kind of helped us. And we learned from our problems, the whole industry did. And then another one came along, salmonella, Listeria, listeriosis. And there was an outfit in California making Mexican cheese. And Listeria, monocytogenes, Listeria was getting into the cheese. If women get Listeria poisoning, if they're pregnant, they lose their baby. Immunocompromised people would end up dying. They killed some people there. And so that what came out of that was environmental sampling, because there's bacteria that exist in the environment of your milk plant. And that started we started doing a monthly environmental swabs, where you go around to your drains and make sure they were being cleaned. You swab it, and you send that swab, and you'd send a whole, you'd swab all over the place in the plant. And send them to a lab, and they'd tell you if you had a positive or a negative or listeria, and you know, they knew where it was by how the sample was identified. And you go back, extra sanitation in that area, and resample it, and come back negative, hopefully, the next time. So, yeah, those were the major drives. The Milk Safety Initiative and that listeria outbreak. And that's how the industry is changing itself over the years, by what they learn from their mistakes. That's why they started pasteurizing, they're killing all these babies, and nobody wants to do that. So they figured that pasteurization, which is a time-temperature relationship, would kill the bacteria, the pathogenic bacteria. And there's several kinds of pasteurization. One is a vat pasteurization, where you heat the milk up to 145 degrees and hold it there for 30 minutes. Or it's a time temperature thing. You could heat it up to 161 and hold it for 16 seconds. Or you could do the aseptic thing and you heat it up to 280 degrees and hold it for a second, and do the same thing that you did with the 45 at 30 minutes. And so that has changed a lot. And distribution has changed a lot. Used to be a milk plant would just be producing for their routes and going to stores in their areas. Now the specialized plants like the Winchester or Oneida, that goes cross-country. Goes to ships at sea. They put it in refrigerated containers in a port someplace, and it goes out to sea, and our soldiers are using it, fresh milk on the boat, or Guam or wherever they have I don't know what was getting into Afghanistan or Iraq, but I'm sure some kind of fresh milk was. The soldiers loved it because it's like being back home. And wars prior to this, it was all reconstituted powder, and it was lumpy and chunky, and it just wasn't the same as fresh milk. And they would see the label, hood label, come, oh, I know that, I used to have that as a kid. So, that really helped. Yeah, consolidation and process and quality improvements has been the biggest thing.
And how did you end up back here in Hartwick?
Always loved. Grew up in Hartwick, grew up in a family home, and we would come, and my parents had a camp, so to speak, out in the country up above Hartwick, 4 miles away. We used to go stay there in the summers, and when my kids were little, we'd come down, stay there, it was empty, and my parents would be in town, and we would stay there, and even the kids have fond memories of it here, they enjoy it. Now, my brother kind of did the same thing. I moved down before I retired. I worked out of my house for a year or two, I think. Didn't matter where I was. With computers now, you can be any place and do your job. You can be in a restaurant, or you got your cell phone and your computer. That was a change. Technical change, the way your management changed, you've kind of extended your workday by an hour. Because you'd work all day and you'd go back to your hotel room. God, I got to sign up, look at my emails and catch up on them. And some days there'd be 100 of them there. And so some you respond to, some you throw away. And just to keep you up in driving time, driving to Winchester. I'd be on a phone conference, hands-free device, so I was legal. But I'd be on a conference call for 3 or 4 hours, and which was helpful. I didn't need to sit in the plant on that and then have to drive home. I could catch up on that stuff in the car. Yeah, so, yeah, it's the way, just the way you did business. Everybody had a laptop computer and knew how to use it. Now, all of a sudden, they break down, and every plant now has a technical guy, computer software guy, can fix it for you. Video conferencing is big. We did some of that. Using Microsoft Outlook, everybody use that. You can see when everybody's, when I schedule a meeting, you go in and see when everybody's free. And I forget to put my lunch down as I was busy, and somebody scheduled me for a conference call at lunchtime because I wasn't busy. and that kind of was catching up to me too. And my wife and I liked it down here. We had the history of coming here. We lived in Casanova for most of the time. We raised our family. And my parents, before they passed away, we divided up the farm into like three sections. And I got one, my brother got one, my sister got the other, and my little brother got the house in town. So we kind of built a camp there. We would come down in the summer. We'd bring our two or three horses with us. I had a horse barn there with a little one-room apartment on the other side where we would stay. And, the kids would come. We all just really enjoyed it there. So we kind of stepped into it. We did that for 6-7 years, and then we decided to sell the house in Casanova and build one down here. And we did that. My son, he lives in Casanova. He stayed there. My daughter lives in Oneonta. She settled here. She went to Oneonta State, so she kind of liked the area too. My son went to Albany, UAlbany. And I've been very fortunate with my kids. My son, hard worker, went to UAlbany, and you couldn't take a car there your first year. So he figured that out. He had enough AP credits, so he had himself declared a sophomore in the fall. So, and then he ended up graduating in 3 years from Albany and went to Albany Law School. Did that. Did very well there. Passed his bar and got married in the same month. And he works in Syracuse now. Very busy. And we have a grandson from him. Little Jacob. Jacob David. My son is David Jr. And then our daughter went to Oneonta. No real teaching prospects. So she took off for Albany, got her master's in, I think, 14 months, and is teaching. She's a reading specialist at Gilbertsville, Mount Upton. And her and her fiancé are going to get married in July. So this is the year of the wedding, the year of Leah's wedding. And every week it's something different. They had to go to Syracuse to make an appointment to try on the wedding dress, and ordered a wedding dress. The wedding dress came. They went up to look at it last week, and the wedding dress wasn't right, so that's got to go back. They're going to Utica to do something this week. I just don't know. The engagement party we already had, and meet the parents and their siblings, or their kids. Are the kids very nice people. And her fiancé, Darren, he teaches fourth grade at Gilbertsville, so that's how they met. So, a lot of, I get a lot of quiet joy out of the family, just thinking about them, how good they are, and just don't understand how kids can get screwed up like this. Well, I do understand now because I have my retirement job, and it's I drive a school bus for Cooperstown. Not so much for the money part of it, but something to do to take up my time. My wife is still working. She works. She's deputy county clerk. Clerk of the board, deputy county clerk of the board, which she likes. And I see changes in Hartwick. My route, my bus route takes me in through Hartwick. I go by my house where I grew up every day. And when we were there, we grew up there. There were stores in town. My father and his family had a store, a third-generation store. My father was a third generation to have it. And there were nice families in town. You'd never hear of women having children out of wedlock. It happened, but you know, not a lot. Or people living together. You just didn't see that. And now you pull up to a house, and three kids come running out. They all got different last names. Same mother, three different fathers. Or you get the kids that nobody wants them. You know, they're living with the grandparents because the mother and father don't want them. And there's some pretty screwed up kids. And, you know, my bus run is one of the tougher ones, I think. I used to have Pierstown. I had that for a year, which is up here. And they're all bids, so... You know, I was just after my appointment, and they can appoint me to fill a guy's rest of his school year. I did that at Pierstown. And there were just some wonderful, wonderful kids on there, very talented kids. One girl, she says, I'm going for my piano lessons. And I, oh, really? Yeah, we're doing Bach in third minor or something. And, you know, they're just really good kids there. And they still speak to me and like it. The Hartwick one is just, it's troublesome. And it's because I think of the parents. The kids don't think anybody wants them. They reach out to gain attention. And there's some good ones, too, trying to bring them along. I've had trouble with a couple of them this year. I just had, last Thursday, I found out yesterday that, and you can't see, buses are built for safety, so they call it compartmentalizing, where the seat in front of them is like this. I can't see unless they stand up. So you're trying to drive the bus, and you're looking in your mirror, and you don't see anything going on. Well, turns out that last Thursday, and this came out of two little girls that... two of the big kids were back there doing some kind of sexual act, and the little girl saw it. So they tell their mother, and the mother goes to school. And nobody's blaming me in any way, but geez, I just wished if I'd have known, you know, if they'd have said something to me, I'd have put an end to it right there, but I didn't. And I try to say good morning to them every morning, have a nice night, that kind of stuff. Maybe nobody says that to them. Part of the retirement plan, we bought a camper, travel trailer, and we started using that this past summer, and do it for family things. The kids come visit us. They come visit us up north, and they camp out too. And if we didn't have that, we wouldn't be seeing them for that weekend probably. So that's kind of enjoyable. Where we go from here, who knows? My wife will retire at some point. We're lucky enough to get our health insurance through her, which she can take when she retires. And I start on Social Security next year, and that'll help out. But mostly you just got to live and enjoy yourself and not worry about it. And it doesn't help to, you know, I read the obituaries every day and you see people, you know, 58, 62, and oh my God. Or you see somebody you grew up with, oh, he's an old man.
Well, do you have any final comments?
No, I think this is a neat program. I wish everybody could do it because it's documented now. My kids, my grandchildren, can always go in and listen to me tell my story. I was out in Salt Lake City at a conference, and I went to the Mormon Library there. And they do a lot of this stuff and digital, and you can, you know, leave your life story there, and people in the future can go back and listen to it. That's really, really neat, I think. You know, how neat would it be to have me go back to my great grandfather and hear what kind of stuff he did during his life and what was going on and what was important and what wasn't.
Well, we really appreciate your participation in it, and thank you very much.
I tried to do my best.